This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Tom Sisti. Tom is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. So this show, we're going to talk about the procurement marketplace. You are a noted procurement historian, right, Tom?
Noted.
Okay. And, you know, we can talk about where the market is right now, what we're seeing going on, and just some general thoughts about, you know, how we got to where we are and, you know, maybe there are prescriptions for moving forward. But first, you know, when we were preparing for the show, Tom, you sort of made this comment, and it is one of my favorite movie trilogies, Back to the Future. And you said, in the procurement system, we're sort of back to the future right now. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's an interesting time, because if you were to go back about 20, 25 years in that time frame, look at some of the concerns we had. We had concerns with intensive oversight by pick your entity. We had concerns about non-commercial activities for commercial or commodity buys. We had concerns about the protest process or the right to complain generally. But we had concerns that we might have too many competitors in the marketplace while at the same time saying we wanted to maximize competition. We're starting to see those arguments blossom again, and it's really very strange because the laws that were enacted over the years from the mid-90s on were all directed to address those problems. So you just wonder what has happened. Has the institutional force of contracting come full circle on itself? Are we putting stresses and strains on the acquisition workforce? What are the issues that are driving that?
Right. And you know, I just, you know, I'm wondering too, and just get your, you know, to me when you just walk through that, you know, is it an issue of, you know, when you stop and think about what we've been through, right? You know, you had that acquisition reform in the 90s, then you had 9/11, right? And then you had this, you know, the pace of, you know, procurement and the amount of work that was being done to support the, you know, the war on terror and, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, the workforce had shrunk post Cold War, you know, dividend, peace dividend, and, you know, the number of acquisition professionals, especially DOD, shrunk. So you're trying to do, and we did streamline the process, and I know this is a long soliloquy, but I'm going to get to my point in a second. So, you know, was part of it, do you think that, you know, what happened, inevitably there were mistakes made in the procurement process? And it's in the context of supporting the war effort, right? I mean, things happen. That's, you know, the nature of the world we live in. Is it the reaction to that, do you think, that sort of led to, you know, what we're seeing, and, you know, layering on of additional requirements for commercial item contracting, you know, the oversight environment, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's inspector generals, GAO, Congress, you know, just, you know, the press, everybody just sort of, you know, piling on to the procurement system?
Well, I think it's a confluence of a bunch of issues. I think you named some of them. Certainly, we had a reduction in staff. We had a tremendous jump in acquisition demand, obviously, post 9/11. We are just as a government probably buying much more than we bought before. The technology is evolving quicker. So right. As it evolves quicker, the demand for new technology increases. So you have the system sort of running into itself a little bit. I think you have a bunch of those issues that come into play that then create the oversight challenge. And, you know, and maybe it's also a little bit of the traditional oversight that we've done over the last multiple decades.
Yes.
Maybe it's sort of the identification of the problem, and maybe we need to be thinking about leafing in the oversight process so that it becomes part of the solution. In other words, right. if we identify issues up front, what are the suggestions that we can make in the oversight process to not be so disruptive to a given program?
Sure. And I to that point, though, I also wanted to mention the one I didn't think of and your thought on is that you mentioned technology and the rapid changes in technology and what the government buys and how it's using technology to acquire those, but also services, right? You know, it's a service economy. And, you know, back in the early 90s, we were buying things. Now we buy people. And that's a much more difficult process. There's, the shades of gray in that area. It's much more challenging. And the FAR, frankly, is still written around product, right?
Yeah. I think also it's sort of emblematic of the issue of having less people to work the process, so you bring other people in. And, you know, when you get beyond commoditized, if you will, services, you know, services that are easy to define, that's where we get into the gray area and it becomes very difficult to buy. And of course, you have the attendant issues associated with services acquisition. You have to be careful with respect to organizational conflicts of interest, whether you have people exposing exposing competitors to each other's data, things like that.
So let's start unpacking a little bit of this. So let's talk about oversight a little bit first. So where do you think we are in the context? I mean, we've touched on it and sort of said, whoa, there's a lot where the oversight is, you know, very intensive right now. Do you think it's that way? I believe you do. But also, how do we put balance back in the, you know, what are the solutions to addressing, you know, the current oversight climate, which I think is out of balance to the detriment of the ability of the government to manage?
Well, I think first you have to almost always say up front, we need oversight.
Oh,
because
absolutely.
The argument is not to not have oversight. You need oversight in the process. It's critical when you're safeguarding the expenditure of public funds.
Absolutely.
Understanding that, I think you have to also be sensitive to the psychology of oversight, if you will, that oversight, even legitimately conducted oversight, sets up a chill. It's a natural chill. So it goes part and parcel with employee training, making sure you have an acquisition workforce that is confident, that is experienced and confident in what they do so that their decisions can be justified if they make them. At the same time, I don't think you want to have, I think you have to have, let's put it this way, a deliberation over an oversight issue. When you find a procurement problem and it's a reasonable exercise of judgment consistent with the rights under FAR Part 1, let's say, if something's not restricted, it's permitted, basically.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So somebody exercises their reasonable discretion in a process. Do you treat a problem that arises under that the same way you would treat a problem with the hot tub guy, you know,
right,
the
right.
agency?
Mm-hmm.
So, those are two different issues. One is somebody good making a good faith decision to try and do the right thing,
right,
versus somebody else maybe not making as deliberate a decision.
Right, and as part of the training, it seems to me too that I think on the flip, you know, for example, in the Inspector General's office, I think it'd be very beneficial in the procurement world. If there's more training, of auditors or whoever oversight folks on the procurement process itself, how it works. I mean, there's a lot because there's new folks. I think they have some of the same challenges that procurement professionals do. Is that younger folks coming in, they don't have the experience. There's been a lot of people retire. You know, that sort of collaborative training. I mean, there's an opportunity, I think, there for sort of cross-pollinization, for lack of a better term.
Well, I agree. But the flip side of that is also it would be helpful to have maybe IG instruction of our contracting people, so that they understand what's being examined when an IG auditor comes in. That it's try and build a collaborative process around the oversight process, as opposed to a identification of a problem report. Let's move beyond that and move towards program fulfillment.
Right, and what are the solutions to that problem? Yes. As opposed to positive solutions. So, right. Hey Tom, look at that. We've already come to the first break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more to Tom Sisti, Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. And we'll continue our discussion of the procurement system. And I think the next issue we want to talk about is contract duplication, Tom. So be ready when we come back from the break. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Shouldn't a workstation live up to its billing? If yours are no longer working, there's Initiate from the Han Company. Initiate workstations are easy to order, install, and reconfigure. Components fit precisely and provide endless ways for space planners to arrange people. Initiate is also highly sustainable, helping reduce your environmental footprint. Initiate workstations, inspired by the practical needs of the workplace. Online at hon.com. That's HON.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Sisti. Tom is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. And, you know, Tom is he has a long history in the procurement. I mentioned you're a procurement historian. You worked on the Hill. Right at some, you know, and dealing with procurement issues, FTS 2000, all those wonderful times.
Yeah. Well, I think we're at GSA together.
Right, yeah. GSA, and then now with SAP, and you know, is a thought leader in our community. I've got to compliment you a little bit. So Tom, when we come back, we were going to talk a little bit about contract duplication, and you know, that is something that you know throughout the procurement community, I hear about. From companies, I hear it from government folks. There's too many contracts chasing the same or similar products or services across the federal enterprise. And you know, to me, that's a fundamental issue when you talk about strategic sourcing and how you define it or not define it. You know, if it's about buying smarter and more effectively for the taxpayer, addressing. Contract duplication has to be in the conversation somewhere. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, you have to understand that contracts, you know, an agency goes out with specific requirements, and so at the threshold, you have to say, are the requirements the same? And you know, I think there's always a lot of criticism that agencies have really the same. You know, they say they're different, but they're not. You know, you have to respect that agencies have different missions that they have to go out. And they have to define their requirements against those missions. And what might not be apparent is that there are distinctions there. That said, I think you have issues with any new program that you want to put in place. What is the impact on existing programs? What's the administrative cost associated with those programs? I mean, you sort of have to do a total cost of acquisition analysis. And what's the What data exists to justify the next step, the next program? You know, what is the cost of adding a new program, of restricting vendors, say, in the marketplace? Are you diminishing competition? You know, those are the types of issues that have to be vetted before you take on another program and allow existing programs to run as well.
Right. Well, I mean, fundamentally, too, is there a pre-existing contract vehicle that will meet my needs? Do I need to establish something, or can I do task order competitions or BPAs off the schedule, theoretically, that will meet my needs? Because that infrastructure cost, the bid and proposal costs for creating, as you pointed out, a whole new program. You know, there's got to be some return on the investment there ultimately for the taxpayer, but you know, for a contractor as well, right? I mean, you're not in business not to make money, right?
Well, but you mentioned something that's interesting. You know, do I have a vehicle that could meet my needs? And if the answer to that is no, I think we have to ask, well, what's wrong with the vehicle? You know, for
great
instance,
point.
If somebody says the schedules can't meet my needs, well, why is that? Is it because you can't get other direct costs? Is it because you have to... somebody has, from a regulatory standpoint, said that you have to have multiple award BPAs, which, you know, it really is a little troubling, because what you're saying is I have a schedule.
Right.
And then I'm going to issue a BPA for a defined requirement, set of terms and conditions, right? that's going to effectively be a subschedule against which you will issue a task order. I mean, that's a little strange.
Right.
It's all a little administrative.
Right. Well, I think there's a great term. That's vertical contract duplication,
yes.
Tom. That's because here, like your point, you got the schedule, then you've got to award the multiple award BPAs, and then when you have a specific requirement, you have to take those multiple BPAs and compete them at the task order level. It does not, you know, make any sense. And I mean, I think it gets, and you mentioned requirements. I think it's back to requirements. Do you have defined requirements? If you do, you ought to be trying to, you know, essentially, for lack of a better term, pick a winner, right? You're going
right.
to do a single award BPA, or you're going to compete a task order, you know, or compete the BPA and get one contractor in it to do the work. You know, you mentioned, how did you say, total
cost of acquisition.
Total cost of acquisition, you know, or I'd say total acquisition cost, the TAC,
right.
You know, whatever. But, you know, I mean, are you aware of any good measures of, you know, of total acquisition cost, or how you do that? Or what are just things you'd think about if you're going
to
do that?
I think your methodology has to be, what does it cost to do it now? What are my internal administrative costs? What does it cost to set people up? What are the bid prep costs that ultimately are going to manifest themselves in prices, whether you think so or not, because there's no free lunch, right?
Right, right.
And then what's the cost of a second agency, let's say, setting up a vehicle, their costs, the cost of competing that? How is that the cost of that overarching risk of multiple channels then factored into the prices that the government pays? I mean, there are different dimensions to this. I have to believe that somebody has studied this throughout government. You know, but you know, those are the things you have to start with.
Right.
It should be a data-driven decision. It shouldn't be sort of an intuitive decision, because you know you were in a time of tight budgets. We have sequestration, we have furloughs. We ought to be thinking about how we're spending our money in the administrative acquisition process.
Yeah, and it's tight budgets on both sides.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And well, you know, and last thought, I want to get your thoughts. You know, one of the things that I've also, you know, feedback I've gotten about contract duplication is that it's actually a barrier to entry into the federal market for small businesses, and it also impacts large companies as well, just in terms of, you know, the amount of money, you know, the flavor of the month is this new IDIQ that's coming out of, you know, Navy or wherever. And so everybody feels like they've got to compete for that. And then that's the next one and then the next one. And, you know, there's only a limited pool of bid and proposal, especially for small businesses.
Well, I think so. Look, it's intuitive from that standpoint. The more you do, the more you have to spend. Okay. And so before we do that, we ought to make sure that we've identified what the costs are associated with the vehicle. And then if you say, well, this vehicle can't do it, going back to that point, you ought to say, well, why can't we manage this acquisition through this vehicle, especially if we set up a secondary vehicle that's very much like it?
Right. So yeah, to your point about other direct costs
yeah.
on schedules and the ability to provide a total solution. And, you know, there is a solution there that, you know, that is in the current regulations. And then you also mentioned as well the idea of BPAs and, you know, multiple BPAs. And I just want to pick up that, because that's a great point. You know, back in the our heyday, I guess, so to speak, right, in the 90s, you know, the idea of blanket purchase agreements off the GSA schedules was sort of groundbreaking. It was a new idea. But the idea there was to take, let's say, I know I'm agency X, and I know, like, over an implementation period, we're going to have to buy 3,000 computers. So rather than, like, you know, order one is 100 and I compete that, and then next, you'd say, okay, I'm going to consolidate that or take that recurring requirement, compete it amongst the scheduled contractors and award one, because I have a firm requirement there. Compete it and award that, and then be able to execute against the BPA. We've lost that, don't you think?
No, I think, you know, you have to get back to the beginning, you know, with BPAs. And, you know, a BPA, you remember this from basic procurement, you issued a BPA with a company because you had, as you said, recurring requirements. So think of it, I know I'm going to buy 3,600 spark plugs this month. I know I'm going to buy, you know, that kind of thing. And so it didn't mean necessarily that you would avoid competition. You still had to compete
right?
Under CECA. So you now leverage that process into the schedule process, issuing it against the schedule. That's fine. But I think what might have happened is there was a conflating of rules. Because if you remember with FASA, we talked about multiple award IDIQs.
Okay.
And the desire to have, there was a preference for the award, a multiple award of contracts. Well, I don't think that language spoke to BPAs.
No, they did not. Not especially not scheduled BPAs.
Yes. So I think, but what I think happened is that it got subsumed.
Sure, I think you're absolutely right. That's a great point.
And because of that, we have a schedule under schedule. So it's creating a lot of administrative strain, especially, you know, for these poor contracting people who are, you know, already overburdened.
Right. And then again, that's vertical contract duplication. And Tom, we have to take our next break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more to Tom Sisti, Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. And we'll talk a little bit about past performance. We'll talk maybe a little bit of schedules modernization. Just continue our potpourri of issues across our procurement system. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Sisti. Tom is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. And we're doing a sort of potpourri discussion around various procurement issues. And, you know, one of the ones, Tom, we wanted to tackle during this segment is talk a little bit about past performance and, you know, just, you know, the focus on it over the last, I think it started back in the 90s, right, late 90s, and, you know, Steve Kelman and, you know, of PP and the importance of evaluation of past performance and, you know, where we are today with PPERS and CPARS and all that sort of thing. You know, I just want to get some of your thoughts about that process.
Well, I think you have to recognize that whole process had its roots in acquisition reform in the early 90s. And the goal was to have a way to evaluate performance against contract terms and conditions and really give a scorecard, if you will, to the vendors performing and have it become part of the evaluation process. I think with past performance, there's always this tension between what we might experience as civilians.
Sure,
you will. You know, when we go out and we buy something online, I'm sure you do the same thing. You look and you say, okay, that's a 4.5 stars. Let's see what people have said. And this
right.
is 3 stars.
Restaurants, right.
Right.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. All those kind of things. Yeah.
We look at the review, the write-ups and everything else. And I think there's a tremendous intuitive pressure for people to say, well, why can't we do that with contracts? Well, a couple of reasons. One, you're dealing with the public fisc. So you're dealing with people spending other people's money, the public's money, as opposed to you spending your own money. That's a much different decision. You can impose your discretionary standards on how you spend, but when you're spending the public money, there is this belief that there should be elements of fairness, and so you should have
and also accuracy,
criteria.
Right?
Yeah, of course. So that you're evaluating, your methodology is the same, your evaluation is the same. That it's as dispassionate as possible to assure that personal influence is not driving an evaluation of a vendor and the vendor's performance. And the only way you can do that really is to align it with the terms and conditions of the contract. Otherwise, it becomes so open-ended and that you start to raise fairness questions.
Right. And, you know, I always found this interesting in both when I worked in government and then outside, you know, in the evaluations that, you know, always included past performance, just how difficult it is to parse a difference in performance, frankly, between companies, especially, you know, where the stakes are high. Because generally, right, you've got companies who are very accomplished at what they do, competing for the major for major, you know, service requirements or even, you know, systems development or IT implementations, and to try to parse, you know, the to have it fundamentally make a difference at that, you know, Section M type best value evaluation. You know, frankly, in the litigations that I worked on, it, you know, only, you know, maybe once or twice where there was a huge disconnect between what a contractor thought he was doing versus what, you know, the government, you know, indicated they were doing, did I ever see it where it really ever made a fundamental difference. Of course, you want good contractors. But in terms of using it as something to try to discriminate between, it's extremely difficult by the very nature of government, right? I mean, it seems to me.
Yeah, you know, the whole concept had some birthing pains. I mean, I think you may remember some of the early cases because they tried to measure how much a vendor protested, for instance.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was nixed. And I think there is a legitimate claim on the, you know, other extreme where there's concern that officials might not want to get, you know, hung up or wrapped up in a debate over whether you're too unfair or you're too aggressive in your either flattery of a firm or your criticism of a firm. That's why it's almost got to be rooted in the terms and conditions of the contract, because right. Otherwise you start cycling down that path.
Right. And you know, and really, and you get into other variables there too. You go to terms and conditions. I think what you're really referring to there is relevancy, right?
Right.
Relevancy of the particular past performance is a variable as well, and you know, and that's a big issue often, and you know, in companies trying to figure out what they're going to identify and provide as an example. I think that's going on in a way, obviously, in Oasis right now because of the, you know, the pool structure and, you know, the sort of qualifying for the pools. You've got to have tasks that are relevant to those pools. It's a really difficult thing to measure, to have it. And there's so much, to me, in my sense, is that there's so much money and time being spent on it. And, you know, what's the return, ultimately, in the system?
You have to remember, though, I mean, it is always good to test the system. It's always good to strive towards improvement. And certainly we should try to maximize competitive procedures in the federal marketplace to the extent that we can. But at bottom, I think there is a point beyond which the government is not a commercial entity. It has other requirements that are overlaid on it in terms of serving the public interest that don't necessarily exist in the private sector. Not that the private sector is operating against the public interest, but remember the shareholder-driven interests.
Sure, they have different interests. That's the world we live in, right?
It is, and it's just so. I think you could go overboard,
right.
You know, trying to parse this out in just the right way, and then of course you have to, like with the other issue, you have to assess the costs associated
right.
with doing.
Right, really. I mean, because I'm sort of trying to visualize it. Is this, we've invested in a system to assess past performance to a point where, you know, people don't want to do, you know, and the government shouldn't be doing, you know, work with contractors who are poor performers. I think the system identifies those, frankly. I really do. But the question is, can you create a system and how much does it cost to get it to the point where you are making, you know, determinations and assessments on a qualitative basis where it makes a difference? And frankly, I just didn't see it when I was looking at, you know, bid protests.
Well, but at the same time, if somebody's not performing, are they in breach? If they're not in breach, then how, what is the criteria?
You know, I mean, that's a different case. I'm trying to take, you know, what's good versus what's satisfactory versus excellent, you know, those kind of
But
variables.
You should identify that up front. In my mind, it should be identified up front. It should be measured against consistently.
Right. Okay. Well, and Tom, I think we have to. Oh, we do have time to keep going. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, I think pricing in general, and maybe a little bit about schedules modernization. And there's a lot of focus right now in the strategic sourcing context about price. And there's a lot. You know, there's a discussion of, you know, reporting pricing and breaking down or unbundling pricing and trying to make sure, you know, the government has the data to make good buying decisions. I guess, first of all, what kind of data is necessary to make those decisions and who has it?
Well, I think the government's right to want to understand what it's paying for something. Any good customer, any good buyer is gonna want to know how they're spending their funds. I think on unraveling that is fundamentally a look at the costs at the point of transaction. You have to say, okay, what are the terms and conditions associated with this cost? Not global terms and conditions, but and what is the quantity I'm delivering? Where am I delivering? What is my time frame? Are there any other exigencies associated with that? Those are the types of issues that roll into that analysis. For instance, you can't compare contract X that seeks to purchase widgets with widgets on a schedule with a defined schedule price. If you do that, it's like looking, comparing a price that you're going to pay for a car against the sticker price that's sitting there in the lot. Those are two different buying activities.
Right.
The walk around on the lot is not a determined purchase point, whereas the sitting there and getting harangued by the salesman is the point at which you're going to engage in the transaction. So in the same way, I think the government has to do that.
Well, to your point, like the GSA schedules, we're talking a guaranteed minimum of $2,500 and then an opportunity to compete for future work at the task order level or under BPAs. That's really a different price point and a point in a transaction versus I know I'm going to buy 100 widgets or 100 cars.
Right.
And give me a price for that.
Which, right. And if you're dealing with a multiple award BPA, it's the second.
You're absolutely right. Very good. Very good, Tom. And you know what, Tom? We're up on the last break. So when we come back, we'll be talking more to Tom Sisti. Tom is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP. And we'll talk a little bit about the Coalition for Government Procurement's charity golf tournament named for Joseph P. Caggiano. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
These days, it seems everyone's talking about the new normal, but federal agencies have a chance to define it. How will you shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. We understand what makes America work and how it can work better. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we can help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, or even change the game. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Tom Sisti, Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP, and we've been talking a little bit about procurement. This segment, we're going to talk a little bit about the Coalition's charity golf tournament for wounded veterans. It's named for Joseph P. Caggiano, who is on the Coalition's Board of Directors. But first, Tom, let's get to the last procurement issue of the day. And we could spend hours talking various procurement issues. We're kind of geeky that way. Excuse me. I can't even get that out. But the big picture question to me, and one I've been thinking about a lot, is, you know, is our system becoming more closed to the commercial marketplace to competition or open? Which, you know, the pendulum swings. I mean, I think the reforms of the 90s, you know, whether it's FASA, Clinger-Cohen, you know, the reform of, you know, GSA schedules, those type of things, they're all about, you know, creating a more open system. It seems like from our conversation, things are becoming more closed. Thoughts?
Well, kind of finding this funny because if you recall, Roger, you and I were supposed to write a paper on this.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, this is I'm not close to that possibility, but for today, let's just talk about it. Okay, this will be first step towards that paper. Okay.
All right. Well, I think go back to 1984. You know, the Competition and Contracting Act, CECA, fundamentally asserts full and open competition.
Right.
That should always, that was our standard. Should always be our standard because we have, from a policy standpoint, said that full and open competition is the means by which the government receives the pressures both on offering and on price that presents the best value to the agency buyer. So to the extent that you have either an affirmative or an implicit restriction on that competition, you have to test it against the value that ultimately is revealed to the government. If the system is too administrative in its intensity, and it raises barriers for people to compete. Those are less people offering solutions and competitive price pressure to the government market space. If it's explicit, then you ought to be assessing what, again, going back to our other arguments or discussions, what data support the need to restrict. Now, of course, you know, CECA has 7 exceptions. Where you're trying to build an industrial base, where there's urgent and compelling, there's even the public interest exception, except I think that that's only been used maybe twice in the history of CECA. But the statute does recognize that there are times where the trade-offs are such that that we need to go to a reduced number of sources or to one source. But outside of that...
Well, that was FTS 2000, right, at some point. Right.
Well, there was competition up front on FTS, right? You had 3 vendors, 2-1.
Sure, that's true.
And you had, as a contract administration activity, you had a periodic competition for revenue shares during the course of FTS 2000.
Right.
So, I mean, you still maintained the element of competition even there, but you didn't make a sole source award.
Right. So, what about, one of the things that to me indicates a more closed system is mandatory discussions around mandatory use and mandatory use in the strategic sourcing context, meaning that as a term of the agreement, the government agrees to buy everything. It's like a requirements contract.
You have the history on this. You worked back in the day on the mandatory schedules, right?
Right.
And what happened then?
Well, what happened is we had litigation and the government had to pay, schedule contractors, millions of dollars for breach because ultimately the government, different agencies chose to, place their own contracts or create their own contracts, breaching those. And the other issue too there, I think it ended up limiting competition over the long run because there was a limited field under the schedules program. And if you had to use them, it limited the options of agencies as to who they could purchase from. And ultimately, over the long term, it did, in fact, limit the pool. Because oftentimes, things that were being bought, you combine mandatory use with a unique description of the item or product, and plus unique government terms. And what you had is you had industries where there were companies that all they did is make stuff for the federal government. It could be files. I remember files.
Wow.
The tool files. A specific government spec and, the quality was poor. You weren't taking advantage of the commercial marketplace. And that was part and parcel of the mandatory use. So, but that's me and mandatory use. So, the other thing I wanted to touch base with you and talk a little bit about is the golf tournament. And I know SAP is as a Keystone member of the coalition, is a sponsor of the charity golf tournament. And this year it is named for Joseph P. Caggiano, who passed away earlier this year. A great guy, great person, great colleague, great, parent, husband, the whole nine. You know him better than I. So it's our honor, frankly, to be able to name the tournament in his memory.
Well, I think anyone who knew Joe, knew Joe was a ex-Navy officer, and wounded veterans were very, very close to his heart. He would drop everything to make sure that if there was a charity event, he got us all into it. I think there isn't a coalition member who hasn't had Joe call him up right before an event and say, "Hey, wait, you have this." And of course, my company, SAP, we are very, very supportive of our veterans. I mean, we hold the Fisher House Golf Classic every year. I mean, we are very, very committed to this, and I personally know that Joe was so dedicated to our soldiers, and as you said, on a personal level, it means an awful lot to those of us who knew him that the coalition named this golf event for him. I could tell you, any given Saturday, I could be on the soccer field, and we'd be texting each other back and forth. I knew he was somewhere else in Montgomery County, doing the same thing. And it was a terrible, terrible loss on a personal level, a professional level, and certainly he died way, way, way before his time.
Right. Well, he was the driving force behind the golf tournament, and it's due to his efforts that, you know, over the last 2 years, the coalition, we've been able to raise through the event over $25,000 to support wounded veterans. And, you know, we've been able to make donations to Operation Second Chance and Hope for the Warriors, to, you know, organizations that support veterans transitioning to the civilian workforce and wounded veterans are doing that. So, and it was without his efforts, we wouldn't have been so successful. So it was a, and I think it remains, you know, something near and dear to his heart. And we do feel honored that we're able to name the tournament in his honor. And we thank the Caggiano family for all their support and assistance. And, you know, with that, some details on the event. There's still, you know, spots available. It is August 28th. I think that's a Wednesday. Coming up, it's at Whiskey Creek, and you can find out more information about it at the Coalition's website. And I want to thank my guest today, Tom Sisti, a senior director and chief legislative counsel at SAP. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.